Welcome to the Ryle Books Podcast. Today I have the pleasure of sharing with you a recording of a reading and conversation with Lauren Baxt that took place on the 16th of March at our space in Brussels. Lauren Baxt is a writer, artist, and scholar working in experimental performance and queer studies. She is a PhD candidate in English at the University of Pennsylvania, where her dissertation focuses on the sociopoetics of lesbian sex and erotics. She curates and organizes the School for Temporary Liveness, a parasite for performance and collective study, the next iteration of which will take place at The Kitchen in July 2025. Her writing on the Click Club is forthcoming in the Drama Review. She lives in Brooklyn with her dog, Riot. Wetness and Surround is a reading of poetic essays and meditations on the submerged materiality of dyke sex in the city. Spinning centrifugally around the research on the Click Club, Wetness and Surround skims the ephemera and transmissions of this legendary to some 1990s party in New York City, where every single place in the club was for sex. Through cycles of dissolution and reappearance, by way of withdrawals and refrains, the writing moves in the spirit of the dispossessive impropriety it studies. Following the reading, I had the pleasure of joining Lauren Baxt in conversation. Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Testing, is that better?
Yes.
Thank you, Chloe, for that introduction and for hosting me and welcoming me to Ryle. And it's just nice that you all came. Like, I didn't know. So it's really sweet that you're here. And yeah, I'm very happy to be here and also try out some kind of different iterations of sharing this research that I've been doing, some of which will take the form of something more like a kind of talk or lecture of sorts, and some of which will be more kind of fragmented, poetic, personal meditations on some of the material. So I think I will just start and let the material kind of speak for itself as I go. And I think that's all I have to say. I heard that the Dyke March is happening.
Yes.
So that seems serendipitous. We can march and read and study and everything together. Also, context, I arrived from New York at 7:40 a.m. this morning. So this reading will be informed by my impending jet lag. So I'm just going to start with, this is some kind of fragments and airplane thoughts. Hello, beautiful. 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 "1994, girls and picking them up, cruising tips for butches, notes from New York City's own Click Club, compiled, made up, witnessed by Julie Tolentino and the Click Club crew, Michelle, Alistair, Robin, Pam, Diviana, Alice, and friends. Suggestion number two, whenever you have a chance, say things like, hello, beautiful. When you stand in front of me, I am at the edge of your bed. My clothes are on. Diesel jeans, white with blue dye, peeking through Levi's gray button-down shirt. yours are off. You say, I'm literally drilling, dripping. I extend my hands and touch the drops of moisture hanging in the hair, air. I move closer when the silicone of the strap feels so dry and lifeless until sliding. I feel the membrane soft and wet around. Clit Club, NYC, 432 West 14th Street. Valentine's Day, on Clit Friday, love, cruise, crush, kiss, wiggle, lick, squeeze, heart, arrows, new DJ, deluxe, Tony C, dance, trance, reggae, hip-hop, women, vision, history, XXXX. The first time you penetrate me, we are in a bathroom in a bar in Baltimore. Subsequently, you are part of a workshop giving feedback to graduate students. Someone has produced a scholarly history of the use of public bathrooms in America. A well-known academic comments, "It's a shame that a dyke culture of bathroom sex never took hold. There is no data or evidence pointing to the existence of a lesbian bathroom sex culture. If a set of practices do not cohere into a formation or rise to the level of a public health concern, do they exist? I'm eating a fried egg on pre-sliced cheddar on toast with three kinds of toppings in small jars, something spicy, something kimchi, and something I can't remember. It is cold outside, but you all know it's toasty inside, and we've added a special heater outside the door to make it even more comfortable for all. Come enjoy us from inside out. Happy Black History Month. The way your hand stays inside my pussy, swallowed, dexterous, there's a brain in my flesh. I send a message to my insides to open. I think about sitting on, riding your hand, imagining, flooding, rushing. Robert Reed Farr writes, to become myself, I have become a lesbian. His lesbianism consists of adolescent fatness that garners humiliation, coupled with a love of his own softness, effeminacy, the pussy he makes himself when he tucks in the mirror, his sister, her lover Rose, and their familial punishment, Black women, Barbara Smith, Audre Lorde, Cheryl Clark, friends, the minor good life, the books and bars and parties and therapy sessions. Eileen Miles writes this recipe. Bodies and books, all our gestures, large, boring gatherings and small, strange meetings, sexual encounters, splashes of light across our faces and bodies in apartments, art on the wall, tapes on the screens, words out loud. Renee Gladman writes, you read and you get wet. What if lesbianism is nothing more and nothing less than an occasion to be wrapped up with you and hear the utterance, you make me so hard and wet? To love all of the ways you have been made penetrable, to love all of the ways you manage that fact, withholding, opening, receding, giving, to love coasting, surfing, skimming these impenetrabilities. Sex devours me, and I have lost my ability to claim it. I try to write it, if not to remember, then to exhibit the immensity of my forgetting. So this talk is excerpted from a longer paper called Erotic City, Slipping into the Clit Club's Lesbian Surround. And the title comes from a 1984 track by Prince, and it opens with an epigraph of the lyrics from the song. If we cannot make babies, maybe we can make some time. Fuck so pretty, you and me, erotic city, come alive. So earlier in the fall, I had the pleasure of meeting Michelle Hill, who is a former member of the Clit Club crew and who worked the door for the now legendary to some New York City party. co-founded by Julie Tolentino and Jocelyn Taylor in 1990 and operating until 2002. The Clit Club was a weekly recurring multiracial and mixed class lesbian party. Hill had been informed I was writing a dissertation in which the Clit Club would feature. "Well, what have you learned?" she leaned back and asked me with an undeniable butch swagger. And for a little bit of context, I was at the co-founder Julie Tolentino's 60th birthday party at a bar in the East Village of New York called Big Bar, which is actually a very tiny bar. And the whole bar is like bathed in red light. And Julie is like falling everywhere and hugging everyone and kissing everyone and screaming. And she kind of brings me over to Michelle and is like, "This is Lauren. She's writing a dissertation on the Clit Club." And Michelle kind of really continues to carry that vocation of like being someone who works the door at a club and is like vetting you as she's talking to you and looking at you. And so I was really like on the spot. I started to kind of tell her what I had learned about the Clit Club. And immediately she was like, "Okay, no, no, talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old. Like, don't give me that, you know, academic BS." But some of the things that I was trying to relay to her, which I will relay to you now, which are kind of important to keep in mind about this party's constitutive elements, is one, that the Clit Club was offering at the time an alternative to the kind of racial discrimination and class divisions that were characterizing the city's lesbian bar culture. So Black women, Latino women, white women never really partied together or never had bars that they could go to together. And there were a lot of discriminatory policies at the predominantly white bars, often kind of double carding women of color, making spaces hostile for trans and gender nonconforming people. So the Clit Club was really trying to like hold its doors open in a very particular way. And so the party was graced by a pleasurably diverse constellation of attendees, what DJ Aldo Hernandez fondly remembers as the Dyke Diaspora, a spectrum of the familia, mixed ages, races, ethnicities, sexual identities, and genders, who made their way to the city's western edge to commune, cruise, drink, watch porn, dance to house music. And that the life force of the dance floor was bound up with the rage and grief unearthed by the onslaught of the AIDS crisis and the loss of dear friends. The first gathering held in the Meatpacking District warehouse was a memorial, and many of its attendees and organizers were part of HIV/AIDS activism, advocacy, and webs of care. And so I'm kind of listing all of these, you know, important components of the party, and finally I say, "And it was a place for lesbians to have sex." And Michelle kind of looks at me and she like puts her hand out. She's like, "No, let me stop you right there." And I got really nervous because I've been like writing this article for a year and I'm like, oh my God, she's going to tell me that it wasn't really a space where women were having sex with each other. But no, what she said was, "We weren't having sex. We were fucking." And so there are like a few, I was trying to think about, okay, what is this emphasis on fucking? I think one way to think about what the Clit Club was doing at this in the early 90s is to situate it within the kind of definitions of lesbianism that lesbian feminism had been cultivating, which, as Heather Love puts it so aptly, was more about sitting in circles than sitting on each other's faces. And so Clit Club was really kind of reconfiguring what the terms of lesbian contact, like in public, in collective space, could be. And I think Hill's emphasis on fucking is a corrective that also kind of signals the pleasures and possibilities that queer sex practices can confer when no future relation, security, or world is promised. And so we can kind of try to conjure in our minds what it might mean when Julie Tolentino and others say that every single place in the club was for sex. So in this talk, I'll turn to a mix of archival fragments and memories, bringing its history as a queerly composed party for lesbian sex and erotic sociality into conversation with the party's tentative yet durational inhabitation of the city landscape. So taking my cues from the party's mode of sociopoetic discomposition, I think with the Clit Club through the emergent heuristic of a lesbian surround. Specific yet permeable, I use the term lesbian surround to denote the deliberate tending of porous and affective atmospheres amidst the cycles of abandonment and enclosure that shape sexuality in the neoliberal city. Less self-contained communities bound by identification, lesbian surrounds are more like indeterminate assemblies around a purposefully submergent or ill-defined call. An early Clit Club flyer from 1990 helps us envision this solicitation. Void of representational imagery, the flyer opts instead for black abstraction, its central image consisting of a matte black rectangle punctuated by the word freedom. Set in relief, the word hovers in the rectangle's bottom right corner as a solicitation to those interpolated by its call. Bordered by minimal textual information, the flyer is a proposition to imagine the opacity of freedom's surround and to participate every Friday in its making and reinvention, thus ritualizing ephemerality and duration as partners in crime rather than binary opposites. And to return to Prince, we can think about this weekly dissolution and reappearance as one of the ways that Clit Club made time. So following Clit Club's fierce devotion to the varied possibilities of what lesbian sociosexual life could be and its spirit of dispossessive impropriety, I suggest that Clit Club prompts us towards lesbian surrounds, not as a model to reproduce, but as a way to think with the generative disordering of practice, identity, and atmosphere. When thinking with the lesbian surround, the question foregoes the binary between identities and acts, sliding away from one's being and even one's doing. Rather than asking, does one belong here? We might ask instead, is this the kind of air one wants to breathe? So apposite to the creation of spaces that purport an enduring or stable commitment to identity, lesbian surrounds foreground the rub of racial difference, gender improvisation, and queer performativity in the making of lesbian desiring fields. Shifting from the more commonly used rubric of lesbian space to that of the surround, I am turning away from contestations over who qualifies to exist in a given space and moving towards a consideration of what forms of life and relation a particular atmosphere might make possible or foreclose. In this regard, Clit Club worked with lesbian social life as a conditional and permeable zone of difference, what Lauren Berlant might call atmosphere-generating juxtaposition, in a way that sought to make the proximity of those differences, with all their unevenness, sexy and pleasurable. And by dwelling in the surround's atmospheric register, I remain hesitant toward the presumption of queer worlds as the necessary formal or theoretical outcome of queer culture and performance. If queer world making can be said to index infrastructural activity that is embedded with a future bound positivism, then a lesbian surround might suggest an uneasy combination of insertion and defection that operates at the level of the para infrastructural. And so I use this term para infrastructural to suggest networks of connection that might not have the institutional or material stability we typically associate with infrastructure, but that nonetheless leverage pre-existing structures to elaborate and provisionally sustain forms of life. In tandem with the pervasive lack of infrastructures for lesbian sociality, a lesbian surround emerges at the interface between need and improvisation, channeling what has been built or designed for other purposes toward ambivalent and unintended uses. The Clit Club's primary haunt for its first decade of existence could be found at 14th and Washington Streets, a location Tolentino has described as a small space at the edge of the city, almost tumbling into the river. The movement of tumbling helps me to feel the vertiginous materiality of queer life as it was bound up with the city, tumbling at the edge describing both the urban geography and the landscape of queer, trans, and lesbian identities and desires unfolding within and around the party. Writing on the peripheries of urban regions, Abdou Malik Simone reminds us that these spaces may indeed be surrounded by both an emergent order of rationalization that will come to settle present uncertainties and a sense that eventually what exists as unprofitable, over or underbuilt, informal or tacitly contested will be normatively valuable. But for the time being, such spaces become opportunities for rehearsal, for experiencing the possibility of being exposed to something unprecedented, caring, and suggestive of new ways of moving and living. How did lesbian sex unfold within this architecture in its heyday before urban sanitization and its logics of value crept west, bringing us to the former site's renovation into what is today a luxury watch retailer? Unlike the homosexual mass that appears in Samuel Delaney's recounting of gay sex at the St. Mark's Baths across town several decades earlier, lesbian sex at the Clit Club seems to have been more dispersed. Sex did not congeal into a recognizable form or gravitate around a center, but rather looked like many things and could be found occurring on the pool table, the dance floor, inside the bathroom, as well as in its illicit waiting line. Quote, "In the early years, a dark room downstairs was available for kink, play, and exhibitionism, and for strict and exploratory S&M, though sex was palpable and explicit throughout the space. Rooms had dark corners and bright centers, and encompassed cooler areas and hot, sweaty ones, places to hang out and talk, places to smoke, and other areas offering relief from smoking. Every single place in the club was for sex. Here, sex is remembered as one activity bleeding into and out of others, becoming indistinguishable from the general hapticality and informal pedagogies of the club. Given that lesbians have historically lacked infrastructures for public sex, what Delaney has described for gay men as the galleries of institutions to accommodate our sex, the social materialities of lesbian erotic life worlds may often evade or fail to constitute something like a queer world and its attendant modes of recognition. For instance, Delaney has elsewhere attributed the lack of lesbian and women-centered venues for public sex to a deficiency in numbers. He writes, "What waits is for enough women to consider such venues as a locus of possible pleasure. I felt that way 20 years ago. Nothing I've heard from the reports in two decades of women's bars and lesbian nights at male leather bars and the reports of men and women from heterosexual sex clubs has made me suspect I am wrong." In Delaney's view, there aren't enough social actors to constitute or beckon a world into being. We might consider, as a counterexample to Delaney's assessment, that the male leather bar served as a formative studio of sorts for party organizer Tolentino's durational performance practice. They recall, "So back in the old days when I ran the Clit Club, I could use the club space to rehearse, but we were always pretty busy and remaking the bar every night so it looked different. My friends, the artist Lovett Codagnone, ran another party called Pork, which was the sister to the Clip Club back in the 90s. Their space was in a leather bar. It wasn't a dungeon, but it had this particular type of audience. So I would come and do some of my projects there. For years, I was just making my work to the back of a bunch of hairy-ass leather men, my workspace. Tolentino channels what has been designed for other purposes in service of unaccounted-for needs and uses, the gay leather bar becoming Solo Dyke performance workspace. Contrary to Delaney's perception of lack, Tolentino's shadow presence in the male leather bar is a registration of what Tiana Reid terms the everywhereness of lesbian sex, even when it might not be recognizable to some as such. Lesbians both pervade and are conscripted to sexual publics, forged as a practice of relation with others and within oneself, under and against the pressures of gendered, racialized, and sexual regimes. Lesbian sex may not regularly take the shape of mass formations, but rather permeates, often surreptitiously, everywhere life is lived. In my search for traces of the Clit Club's urban presence, I was delighted to find a single manila folder of records on file with the words Clit Club scrawled in pencil on its tab in New York City's municipal archives. The folder's contents include a handful of complaints and subsequent correspondence with the mayor's office after the Clit Club threw a disorderly and raucous block party during 1991 Pride Weekend at the corner of Barrow and Commerce Streets in the West Village, a residential intersection further east than its usual meatpacking locale. A letter penned by the particularly incensed resident, Mary K. Doris, provides us with a detailed account of the event. A horribly noisy and boisterous invasion of female celebrants who transformed her otherwise normally highly livable and civilized street into an atmosphere of inappropriate exhortations, end quote. In Doris's words, the block party included massive drunkenness and yelling in unison among celebrants, horribly loud, nonstop disco music with a thudding, heavy bass, semi-nudity, aggressive and grotesque and deliberately exaggerated advertisement of a specific sexual practice point of view. These messages were conveyed through posters stuck on our lampposts, flower planters, etc., and on information tables staffed by the event's organizers. Notice Mary K. Doris's use of the possessive pronoun when referring to sidewalk lampposts. Placing the city's public architecture under her purview, she transforms the street into an extension of the residents' domain, indexing a belief that the city belongs only to its class of property owners and that a neighborhood belongs only to its residents. As we shall see, Doris's tirade against the Clit Club's deviant burst into the neighborhood is subtended by the affects of whiteness and its proprietary world schema. Within the intensifying privatization of public space over the course of the 1990s, a dovetail process of cannibalizing and bending non-sovereign uses of the city towards profitability, and criminalizing and expunging all who remained deviant and expendable, eruptions into public space, like that of the Clit Club's block party, insinuated insurgent social grammars into an increasingly stultified public life. Reading Doris's letter, it becomes clear that what most offended her was not the temporary claiming of city space by minorities, but rather the unabashed and unapologetic spirit of sexual and erotic exhibitionism that pervaded the assembly. She writes, the totally insensitive, vulgar, blasted and screamed poor taste displayed in every aspect of the event, which as far as many of us can see, had nothing at all to do with pride and everything to do with sex. One image in particular from the party's installation crystallized this for Doris. Quote, a clothesline stretched across part of our street with a full line of lightweight rubber gloves suspended from it. Lest the mayor's office question the purpose of such an exposition, Doris annotates her description for the uninitiated reader. A member explained to me these were used for safe sex between women using hands. What her description betrays, whether she likes it or not, is that she too has become a student of the Clit Club's sexual pedagogy. Her language indexes not only her enraged status as a civilized resident, but the ways her very sense of self is buttressed by an erotic fascination and a will to sexual knowledge. As Sharon P. Holland argues, the erotic is not some queer autonomous zone, but rather a possible harbinger of the established order. Reading Doris's aggravation through the heuristic of the lesbian surround asks that we consider her not as an interloper, but as part of Clit Club's temporary urban swarm. Following Fred Moten's assertion that deviance is not opposed to the norm, but rather comes before it, bears it, we can see how Doris's sense of propriety is not simply threatened by the Clit Club's display of sex, it depends on it. Held together by the rhetoric of anti-Black logic, Doris uses quotations around the word human, a sampling of the human problems generated, to cast doubts on the partygoers' abilities to perform and reproduce the genre as such. In so doing, Doris separates the crowd from the, quote, creative artists and business people, elderly disabled neighbors, and children, who she positions as victims of their disturbance, revealing that her dismay is not merely a matter of sexuality, but of sexual practices that disrupt and disintegrate the coherence of whiteness and its attachments to a particular performance of humanistic propriety. The temporary affective shift brought on by the block party marks the potentiality of lesbian socio-sexual life to wreak havoc on established norms of civil comportment. Here, identity is not the cause for disturbance. Rather, the threat is sexual practice, and by extension, the potential inoperativity of lesbian sex for established forms of social reproduction. Eliminating practices of sex that disentangled whiteness from its attachments to privacy in the forms of property ranging from one's living domain to one's body were fundamental to the sanitization and financialization of the city. Lesbian sex in public, as indexed by the clothesline of latex gloves and the web of knowledge that surrounds them, proposes an epistemological shift in one's understanding of what sex can do in the city. The repurposing of the domestic vocabulary of women's work via the clothesline offers an uncanny registration of the regendering that is possible when the materials of everyday life are put to use towards what may appear to be the useless ends of convivial pleasures and freakish desires. Reflecting on Clit Club's attitudes towards sex and sexuality, Shigeru Shiggy McPherson, former door staff and graphic designer, shares, I learned that being a sexual being is not just okay, it's good. This resonated for me even before I learned that being a lesbian is not just okay, it's good. Flipping through the Safer Sex Handbook for Lesbians, written by Tolentino and Cynthia Medansky and distributed throughout the Clit Club in the early 90s, one comes to a spread on fingers, hand, fist. The handbook, which progresses from mouth, lips, tongue, to information on toys, needles, bloodletting, water sports, and welts, reads both as a manual for protecting oneself and one's partners from the transmission of HIV and STIs, and for learning the ins and outs of the many ways that lesbian sex can unfold. On this particular pair of pages, the image on the left shows a hand pulling a latex glove firmly around its other half, which is tightly gripped into the shape of a fist. On the right, instructions are provided. For safe penetration, use a slippery, lubed-up latex glove to enable one finger or a whole fist to safely rock her into a frenzy. In the ricochet between Doris's description and the handbook's suggestion, the image of the latex glove multiplies. Laundry hung out to dry on the city block evokes a future or former occupation when material will have clung around someone's hand on its way to being enveloped inside another's flesh. The surround, now surrounded, folds in on itself.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for sharing this with us. I feel like it's such an exciting research to like have like a little peek into this history of the Click Club. Yeah, also your approach to thinking around this, the lesbian surround. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's so many places to start. but I wanted to maybe ask you a bit more broadly, like how you approach this research, because you come both from like choreography, performance, and then into queer studies.
Yeah.
Thank you. And also, yeah, Chloe sent me such a great list of like responses and questions before this. So I'm just excited to be like in conversation with you. Yeah, how do I approach this research? As Chloe mentioned, like my background is working as a dancer and making performances and being immersed in experimental performance. And I think the way I really came to the Clit Club was through this experience I had in a performance work by Julie Tolentino, which I kind of describe in that last poem, and which makes its way into the essay more significantly, but wasn't included there today for time. But this performance that they did at Performance Space New York in 2019, which included a kind of one-to-one encounter in a mineral bath, and this kind of being escorted through the kind of backstage and interstitial areas of a institution, Performance Space New York, and then having this kind of encounter with Tolentino that was like informed by her decades-long work organizing parties like the Clit Club, but also forms of like sex practice. And so I like left that performance feeling really transformed. And like I had to try to understand more what this artist was doing. And then fast forward, like I'm in a PhD program in an English department and kind of trying to figure out how to bridge my kind of attachments to performance, but also situate performance more
kind of explicitly within histories of queer and particularly like lesbian social life. And so it became like this kind of challenge of how can I think about contemporary performance practices and queer performance practices, but inside this kind of longer lineage. And the Clit Club just kind of kept like calling me as a site to do that. And, you know, like I think now, for instance, Tolentino's work isn't usually thought of like that performance that I experienced wouldn't necessarily be called a lesbian performance or something. But I was kind of interested in thinking about the tactics that Tolentino and the people around her were using to kind of insert the Clit Club into the city, and how those tactics were then showing up in how she worked with this kind of theater and what was possible between an artist and an like audience member, or what's possible between kind of people going to a party to have sex or dance or figure out who they are. So I just approach it very intuitively and also a lot of like reading and digging and just like accumulating what exists in terms of like the archives of the Clit Club and the way it's being remembered, and then in how I'm kind of threading those fragments together.
No, I find it quite an interesting intersection also that this research is happening within the English department, and it's so thought through performance as a genre and a mode. In the longer form of the essay, you also start at the beginning by saying that you approach the Clit Club as a kind of performance, and that the research on the lesbian surround is bringing together or thinking between kind of poetics, aesthetics, and sociality, and kind of merging them. And I think in the essay, like it's a really, I think you make a really exciting case for why that is also a necessary approach to Clit Club, that it also merges between a kind of cultural social project and also an artistic project. But I was curious if you've encountered any problems in that kind of analytical framework that you set up, that the research is embedded in a literature department, and yeah, this kind of approaching, like, are there kind of things that you've had to navigate, or has there been certain kind of questions that you've come across when you're trying to like blur these, basically use this analytical framework?
The first thing that comes to mind when you posed that question to me was a rejection that I received from a kind of established feminist academic publication, where some of the kinds of comments that I received were that the writing was like too theoretical or not historical enough. And I think what that kind of comment points to, and what your question points to, is also the problem of trying to write about something in an academic context that kind of lacks a proper archive, and that also like refuses to be an object of study, and to find a way to write with that thing that doesn't make it then perform as an object, like for me to then kind of make, I don't know, like to make it perform something for me or for the reader. And so, of course, I am kind of like articulating this framework of the surround, but trying to do so in a way that allows the party to continue to perform its own, like to perform its own obscurity, to perform its own opacities, to not try to like make known what can't be known, but rather to be like, how did this work? How did this come to be? How did this stick around for 12 years? Yeah.
And in that, I guess there's like a real question of like what constitutes an archive. From what I read, it also seems a lot of the research and the information and the history is really in people's lived experience, and then it's shared through conversation with you or with other people that has been recorded. And I wonder, like, what you, in also wanting to keep this history of the Click Club kind of dynamic and to also retain its obscurity because it feels also fundamental to what it is, how do you think about archiving in relation to these kind of histories? Like, are there certain forms of archiving that feel more like proper to that history than others, or has it been like a source of frustration? Or,
well, I mean, I think with the Click Club in particular, around, like, I would say around 2015, in concert with other efforts to, like, return to kind of artwork and activism and that was being made around the AIDS crisis, you know, the Click Club, like, people started to want to talk about it, to remember it, to kind of begin to circulate it in kind of queer public memory, because otherwise it would, it's funny doing this, like, research. I've noticed that sometimes, like, everywhere I go, if there's, like, somebody who has been affiliated with dyke culture or identifies as a lesbian, etc., if they were in New York in the 90s and I'm like, oh, I'm writing on the Click Club, then they have a story about going. So it does, like, it has this kind of vibration and afterlife that is very present for people. I presented a version of this talk at a conference in Baltimore, and actually the facilitator of the panel had snuck into the Click Club when they were 17 and had grown up in New York, and they described, like, the sense of kind of walking through the meatpacking district at that time, which was, you know, really this kind of underworld or shadow world. It was filled with the kind of, it was populated by meatpackers. Now there's, like, almost none left. Now it's, like, the Whitney Museum of Art and luxury watch retailers, etc. But at the time it was, like, blood. It was cruising at the piers. It was trans women of color working the stroll as sex workers. It was, like, dungeon parties, and it was the Click Club. And so, kind of, you can imagine being, like, 17, Black queer person, like, walking from 14th Street and 8th Avenue all the way west. And then they had this great memory of, like, walking into the Click Club and being like, it felt like the walls were wet. And I just loved that. I totally digressed from your question. What was the question? archiving.
Yeah, archiving. And if there's, like, but I think, I mean, we can go with wetness. No, it was more just to, if, like, through this research, there's also certain modes of archiving that feel more relevant to keep these histories. But I think your answer was great. I think it is about the history also being retained by it being passed on and encountered, and, like, this.
And I think there have been other efforts recently to document, like, the lesbian bar culture of that time, to produce kind of oral histories and documentaries, and that work is important. And I think because Click Club was doing something that was so kind of singular in its moment, I think that Julie and, like, the crew that worked on the party for so long are particular about how the club gets remembered. So maybe not wanting to then kind of, you know, enter a kind of linear history of, oh, all these lesbian bars were doing, like, lesbian chic together, when, like, Click Club was really kind of maintaining a kind of anti-normative counterculture that then doesn't, you know, that then I would think, or in my study of the Click Club, I wouldn't then want to collapse it into a kind of, like, oh, this is what was happening in the 90s. It maintained a kind of, you know, dissonance that I want to, like, retain in how I write about it. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think when you... sorry, I'm, like, shaking a little bit because it's cold. So cold in here. It's just, like... doing, I don't know, like, adventure sports,
you have to,
interviewing.
Like, get close.
Yeah. When you were talking also about how you distinguish the surround from lesbian spaces and also from modes of world making, like queer world making or lesbian world making, and then you were talking about the surround as being built, like it's a kind of para infrastructure, so thing kind of connections to different forms of, or yeah, different forms of kind of immaterial and temporary kind of connections. I guess the Clit Club, as you said, it's like it was happening every Friday night, or
every Friday.
So you had this like emergence and then it disappears during the week and then it comes back. I was wondering about this in relation to the surround, like how is the surround also as a structure, like how does, sorry, hold on, this question is coming. How does the surround as a structure kind of deal with this relation between like stability, instability, visibility, invisibility, and how does it kind of think of either using invisibility and instability as forms of like political strategy? Because it feels like that's also what distinguishes it from a space and a world making.
Yes. Yeah, I think the surround, the, you know, I'm also drawing on like the work of a lot of other people who think with like how to describe social life as a kind of surround. Particularly, there's an urban scholar, Abdul Malik Simone, who has this book called The Surrounds. And he's writing in particular about kind of forms of like temporary kind of labor in the global south, where workers are constantly having to be moved to like the edges of cities, to temporary housing, to what in many ways seem to be unlivable conditions and are, but then also the ways that these kinds of emergent forms of life and sociality kind of are like innovated in those kinds of sites of pressure, and kind of at the edges of what would appear to be something that's been completely, all value has been extracted. And I think reading his work on thinking about like the city space in the context of capture or modes of capture helped me think about what the Clit Club was doing, because it was in this like peripheral region that had really been abandoned. And that kind of social and infrastructural abandonment allowed for this whole kind of world, in a way, to emerge that wasn't devoid of violence, was constantly being subject to social violence, but was also inside of that subjection, making a kind of new collectivity possible. And so to think about those kinds of forces together, and I think for me what's most important about the surround also as a way to kind of challenge like what we hear when we hear the word lesbian, because I think like lesbian has become over associated with certain forms of like holding on to like gender as a property, like cisness, femaleness as something that like women own, and then we, you know, like that kind of you know, afterlives of certain forms of lesbian feminism that then become turfism, that then become kind of fascist lesbianism, all those, you know, that's kind of overburdened the lesbian as being like only about a certain mode of identity, that is also about keeping things closed. And so when reading about the Clit Club, I was like, oh, this couldn't be farther from that kind of association with lesbian as a mode of living. And so I liked that the surround was like, oh, it's like porous, it's open, the space was never totally shut off. You know, like the trans women, the fags, the lesbians, the dykes, everyone was there. And it took a lot of work in that moment to actually make a space where like the people at the door were saying, oh no, yes, come in, like yes, come in, and that was also kind of learning that everyone in the space constantly had to do, and that kind you know, navigating that tension between something that is specific, lesbian, dyke, a space for people who are drawn to that sociality and sexuality, but that is also like still porous. And I think that sometimes, yeah, lesbian space or queer world, it can suggest or a kind of boundedness or closure. Yeah.
And do you have an interest in, is your use of the word lesbian then in Lesbian Surround, is it also, is there a kind of project to like reclaim that from this like TERF exclusionary or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it is actually to invest it again in another, to make it once again like a kind of functioning term that could be like comparable, like that could be contemporary in a way that queer feels.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is. And I think people, I don't think I'm like alone. And it's also, you know, funny to see that like the 90s was also a time when there was a kind of lesbian like mainstream representation in a really like new way that hadn't happened previously historically. And we're in another kind of moment of like lesbian, a lesbian renaissance in pop culture or something. So I think that is also mirroring other kind of minor interests like that of myself. But yeah, I do think that the term lesbian has been historically like overburdened by whiteness and cisness, and that there is like work to be done to like, you know, open up the uses of what that word does, because it's done like a lot for me in my life. Or like when Robert Reed Farr says, to become myself, I have become a lesbian. Like, I'm like, me too. and so it's like something that I believe in. Yeah.
And it also, it makes sense, I'm thinking now, to your talk when you said something about this, the surround, you no longer ask the question, do I belong, but do I want to breathe this air? Mm-hmm. And that feels also like a similar relation to then thinking sexuality, that is, it is less about occupying a certain position than it is about engaging in an activity that is like moving between some kind of internal and externalization, which feels like it's an interesting way to approach both somehow these kind of social structures, but also the person. Maybe I ask one more question and then I can open if there's any questions there. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about water. And I mean, in the, you come to it a little bit, or you come to it in the poem as you start with this, the scene of you swimming. And then it goes into the performance by Julie Tolentino, which is also this immersion in mineral water. And then this reflection also of the Click Club being as if the walls were wet. And I wondered how you think about water or wetness, either in its like real materiality or in a metaphorical sense, as a kind of social mediator.
I guess it's something I'm still like, it's figuring out. It's an interest that has been like surfacing through the materials. Like, I just kept noticing water, like in the bath with Tolentino, thinking about the bathhouse and the kind of sweat and vapor and immersion, thinking about dancing at a party and like sweat and feeling like the whole space is kind of like tight and that like air is being shared through like molecules and what the kind of feeling of like being pushed and pulled into and around other people's bodies in a dance floor or in this like pool with Julie or in the block party when it starts to rain and everyone starts to take their shirts off. Like, I was just thinking about how water intervenes or gets like produced by these different social situations. And then also, I guess, a question is how to think like the materiality of lesbian sex, like at the level of the body, in terms of something that like sex practices where statements like "you make me wet," "let's get wet," "you're so wet," like all of that is kind of you know, animating the situation. And so how to think a kind of like materialism of wetness that is does not then fold back into like an essentialism or a kind of sexed or gendered essentialism, but is actually thinking about what like that wetness does and then how it moves from something like a kind of sexual encounter out into the social and back in again. So it's non-metaphorical, I think, but it's also, an emergent way of thinking for me.
Great. Are there any questions that anyone would like to ask? You don't have to do it with the microphone if that's a hurdle.
Yes.
Yeah, I was curious about the thing where you talk about how the TikTok was multiracial and multi-class. I felt that one that relates to the types of archives to deal with how you encounter that.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, one of the other recommendations in the day's book where you actually want to be the first content. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how that shows up in your work.
I think some of it is that it shows up in terms of like the decisions that organizers made in terms of how the party was organized, how flyers were distributed, who was on those flyers, what they kind of signaled through the bodies or people being shown through the language being used. I specifically like work with a flyer that is kind of non-figural, like doesn't show a body, but others do. And also things like how much it was very cheap to get in. It was affordable. The party wasn't performing any kinds of like, red carpet, or it wasn't trying to make itself elite in a way that a lot of other kind of like lesbian lipstick parties of the moment were doing, like Cafe Tabac or these other spaces. But I think sometimes in the archive, especially when it comes to class, that the registration of multi-classed participation shows up sometimes as an absence, because what happens in the archive is that it's like whoever is able to write themselves into an archive is then like who shows up. So one of the ways that I think class shows up as well as race is through like this letter from Mary Kay Doris, where we can read that she's like so disturbed by the way her sense of propriety in terms of like what she thinks, who she thinks belongs on her street or what those people might be doing is disrupted by like who shows up and how they signify in terms of class and race. So that letter is like doing a lot of work for me, but I think it indexes like the antagonisms between like a party like Click Club and others. Some of it is also like trusting what people tell me or what people have said about what happened and who was there and what their priorities were.
I wonder, if you're someone who went to the club when they were 17, what's your urgency around responding to that kind of archival material? Do you feel like you have this urgency to write it down, archive it, multiply it, like store it for the future or whatever? Or do you feel like it's enough for them to be stored in the bodies of the people and you're okay with like them dying out?
I don't feel like it's totally up to me, or you know, I don't feel like I have a kind of like ownership over the archive. I hope that like when this writing comes out as an article and that like the kind of citations and footnotes actually like contribute to that archiving process and maybe less as archiving and more as a kind of theoretical project, like how to take these kinds of traces or like ephemeral moments, and maybe they don't constitute a kind of material that goes into a storage box, but can kind of live on in a text that then can continue to be read and then cited again in the future. So I see a kind of like the essay is a gathering place for the various, you know, memories and glimpses that I like encounter through my research. So I'm trying to include as much as possible. And then there are, you know, there is an archive of flyers that Julie Tolentino holds. I've heard there's a box in someone's apartment with some like underwear and merch. I've seen some photos of. I went to the Lesbian Her Story archives. There's some flyers in a file there. I mean, it's like really like evaporated. It feels like it's something that's, you know, falling away as you try to study it. But then it's really so much is in the memories of the people who went there and also the gossip around it. Like, did you go to the Clit Club? No. Thanks for the question.
Is there...
I was wondering within the current context, how does the relation with archiving, like writing a paper, and what, how does that shift something?
I mean, something that I just noticed is that, you know, this is an image from the Safer Sex Handbook for Lesbians that was produced, you know, by the Clit Club in collaboration with the Gay Men's Health Crisis. And there's a PDF of this that has just been like online that I've always been able to go like look it up. The PDF is there. I also have it downloaded, but I went to trying to look at it for something in preparation for today and find the link. And the link is like not online anymore. And I don't know if that has to do with the kind of current increasing censorship and kind of destruction of the kind of internet presence of lesbian, queer, trans history, but it felt like slightly jarring, or like it might anyway. And of course, we know that that's happening. So I think, I mean, my feeling is that like I was already doing this work and I will keep doing this work in the most ethical way that I know how, and trying to keep doing it with other people too. But yeah, it is alarming. And I think also, you know, some of your questions around like how does the surround work alongside infrastructure? It's like we do need infrastructures for queer life. We need infrastructure for queer sociality. And these things work in complicity or in antagonism, but that's what continues to like sustain queer culture. And so I think it's important to keep fighting for both. Yeah, the like visible and the invisible in tandem. Yeah. And if anyone wants this PDF, I have it, so I can send it to you.
Cool. Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you so much, Lauren. It's been really amazing. Thank you
so much. Yeah. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo. You can find more of our past and upcoming events on our website, www.ryle.space.